Thank you for downloading this episode of In Our Time. For more details about In Our Time and for our terms of use, please go to bbc.co.uk/radio4. I hope you enjoy the programme. Hello. The Priory of St Mary of Bethlehem was founded in London in 1247. At first it cared for the needy in general, but within 200 years it was known as the place to send people with mental illnesses, or lunatics as they were called, supposedly disturbed by the moon. Bethlehem became Bethlehem, which slanged into Bedlam. Before modern reforms, that name was synonymous with chaos. Tourists could and did pay to see patients raving, some in change. Pepys went, so did Dickens. When others were trying more enlightened psychiatric therapies, Bedlam kept the medieval ideas, persisting with purges and vomiting to remove excesses of black bile. Conditions became notorious. Corruption led to a parliamentary inquiry in 1815, which revealed that one patient had been held in a form of cage for almost a decade. As staff said, his wrists were too slim for manacles. With me to discuss the early history of Bedlam are Hilary Marlin, Professor of History at the University of Warwick, Justin Champion, Professor of the History of Early Modern Ideas at Royal Holloway University of London and President of the Historical Association, and Jonathan Andrews, Reader in the History of Psychiatry at Newcastle University. Justin Champion, what were the circumstances in which Bedlam was founded?
Well, the founder was the sometime sheriff and alderman of the City of London, Simon Fitzmary, who, for various reasons to do with the papacy, the Crusades, wanted to create a priory, so an institution that would pray for him and also support the priors of St. Mary in Jerusalem. Jerusalem had fallen in 1157, and this was a project that would do God's work in one sense. And that 1547 foundation laid the physical space for what eventually became Bedlam in the 17th
century. You said 1547, 1247.
1247, yes, absolutely. And that the first instances of, let's call them, you know, in a non-politically correct way, lunatics, as the contemporaries did, was in the early 15th century, around 1403, I think. There were six men who were perhaps restrained by manacles, stocks, and chains. After the Reformation, of course...
I'll come to the Reformation in a minute. So we've got this founded as Bethlehem, a place of mercy. Very few people there, about 20 and that sort of thing, caring for the poor. The church doing the best of Christian thing, caring and looking after the poor, and poor and ill. And that's how it's... How did Bethlehem turn into Bedlam, the word?
Well, I think it's the way people contracted, you know, Bedlam, Bethlehem, Bethlehem. It just evolved, and of course in the later period the slang for Bethlehem was Bedlam, and we need to separate the institution, the care, the charitable works that went on in that physical space from the idea of a Bedlam.
So we have that, and it carries on, let us say, much the same from 1247 to 1347, 1470. And then we're coming to the Reformation. Now, you think that had a big change in the way people regarded, the way people took on their own anguish.
Absolutely. I think that the Reformation has an impact in a sort of institutional sense that Henry VIII is very keen to separate from the papacy. So charitable Catholic foundations like the Priory get a form of independence. And of course, the institution was outside the city walls, so those jurisdictions were at play. But I think the anxieties that are especially brought on by Calvinist's sort of theory of predestination, are you saved or not, create mental instability, create this sort of powerful sense, am I saved or not? Can I read my own sort of salvation through the way I behave? So those sorts of inward-looking introspections from that radical Protestant theology create a very unhealthy environment for madness.
How did that differ from the previous two centuries when we were under Roman Catholicism, and one of the notions of one of the reasons for the word used lunatics was that they were possessed by the devil? It was diabolical.
Absolutely. And
so
I think,
how did these two things contrast?
Well, I think that the Protestant culture still bought into diabolical possession, and, you know, a sign of your damnation is that you've become possessed by some wicked spirit. But the Catholic theology allowed the priests to take intervention methods, to exorcise, to sort of finesse the possession.
And in sometimes not very finessed. I mean, they drill a hole in somebody's head to let out the devil.
Oh, absolutely. The modern clinical trepanning that we know releases pressure on the brain was initially to create a space for devils to crawl out of.
And then the slow turnover to the internalization of madness.
Yeah, I think...
And what was called madness.
What was called madness. And I certainly think by the end of the 16th, the start of the 17th century, there is more understanding of how the mind works. You know, the Robert Burton's Anatomy of Melancholy, that the sorts of projects that investigate what are dreams, can we tell the difference between what's going on inside our brain and what's going on outside? There's an introspection that comes out of, I think, a lot of the Protestant theology. Look inside yourself. You know, madness is something, an imbalance of the mind.
Hilary Marlin, the prevailing view of mental health was one prevailing view. Was that it relied on a balance of humours. If the balance of your humours is in the right proportion, one to the other, you were okay. What's the story behind that?
Yes, both the treatment of madness and understandings of madness for a considerable length of time, from the classical period onward through the medieval period and through to the Reformation, was based on partly on the principle of four humours. And these were vital fluids that were contained in the body, blood, phlegm, yellow bile and black bile. And if they were in balance, then all was well, constitutionally, physically and mentally. However, if they went out of balance, this could cause either physical problems or indeed mental disorders. And a good example of that is accumulation of black bile. If there was too much black bile in the body, this could result in melancholia, it was believed. And it would even result in a kind of discoloration. It was thought that the person would even look black, have black looks.
But this is all theory, isn't it? I mean, there's no, they don't didn't bring any hard evidence to bear.
No, it's theory.
But and it's come from Galen.
It's come from Galen. It came through the Roman period. But it was a very, very durable theory. It was a principle that was used to sort of govern medical practice really right through to the 18th century.
I'm not disputing the durability of the thesis. It's just the fact that it rested on theory and was about 2,000 years old.
It did.
Yes.
Yes, which is quite surprising.
Bizarre.
And it became, I mean, one of the things that Bethlehem is associated with, as you mentioned in the introduction, is the use of bleeding and purges, which was used by other institutions, by other medical practitioners, certainly throughout the 17th and 18th century, when it starts to be brought into question. But it's this very persistence, this therapeutic conservatism, which I think is particularly associated with Bethlehem. And these were the principles of treatment, and particularly spring bleeding. It was thought appropriate to do this at certain times of the year. And of course, this was also something that was shared in popular culture as well. There was a sort of broader understanding outside the medical realm that you had to sort of keep the body in balance. So it was something which had a broad acceptance also outside of Bethlehem.
And there was a sense that lunatics, if the word was used then, were like animals and had to be flogged if they misbehaved. Had to be encouraged to vomit in case they'd eaten something that was causing this problem that their carer, someone, let's use the word, that looked after. This was enforced too.
That's right, and you're right about the word lunatic. They're often referred to as poor lunatics in Bethlehem, and I think the word patient only starts to come into more common usage in the 18th century. And it's certainly true in earlier centuries, probably up to the 17th century, that flogging was used as a form of treatment. And even very eminent physicians like Thomas Willis, who was a physician working in Oxford in the mid-17th century, was advocating bonds and strokes and threatenings as a way of treating lunacy. And I think towards the end of the 17th century, this starts to change. And in Bethlehem, a rule is brought in 1677. Forbidding the flogging of lunatics.
But in that 400 years, that was a course they followed. How did they know when they thought somebody was cured?
Well, I think probably most people, if they were cured, were cured by themselves, not by any medical intervention.
But were people let out?
People were let out, and Bethlehem was all about curing people. It was a charity, so it relied on a good record of curing. Claims were made that around a third of patients in some periods were cured, but they probably spontaneously recovered. And many, of course, were readmitted, which was something actually Bethlehem committed to, that if the patient fell ill again, they would take them once again into their care, if you could call it care.
Jonathan Andrews, the late early 16th century has been briefly alluded to. Those looking after people in Bedlam, as it became called, mentally ill people, how were they trained? Were they recognising that things were different from the humours and so on, the black bile and the yellow bile, and the were they bringing a different form of evidence and medical practice to bear?
Well, one of the early physicians at Bethlehem, Helkiah Crook, was effectively an anatomist with no specialist knowledge of insanity before he arrived at Bethlehem. And that was relatively typical of most of the physicians who attended Bethlehem initially. Now, Helkiah Crook, though, was a critic of Galen, had published a work called Microcosmographia, where he was actually quite critical of Galenic medicine, published quite controversially. And
in so what way? What did he say that was, well, critical, that he, is relevant to this?
He was somewhat critical of the ideas of humoral passage, and he provided a model for anatomy that was rather challenging of anatomical knowledge that had been inherited from Galen. But really, the early masters of Bethlehem were actually quite commonly lay men, and the people doing the day-to-day management, the keepers, were not medically trained at all, and were often coming from kind of lower class service professions, sometimes with backgrounds in the army or from the labouring classes, actually quite poorly qualified in a modern sense. Also, Bethlehem was, of course, attended by surgeons and apothecaries throughout the 17th century, and only though in a visiting capacity. So they would both attend Bridewell, which Bethlehem was conjoined to and jointly governed by, the archetypal House of Correction in London, and they would submit bills, but they didn't actually have to show up at the hospital except to basically give purging, bleeding, and vomiting. They were under no obligation to attend. There was no actually even rules requiring to attend on particular days. Eventually, this shifted to require attendance on 2 or 3 days a week. But really, surgeons and apothecaries at this time were largely trained through apprenticeship, and again would have had general experience in general medicine. weren't recognised as necessarily specialists, you know, with specialist knowledge of insanity.
So would it be too much to say that from 1347 till the end of the 17th century, much the same thing had gone on in Bethlehem, including the corruption, including people turning up for half a day, saying this, that, and the other, and going off with part of the money, and that the exploitation of the inmates, let's call them, was quite severe, and deprived of sufficient food very often, and certainly of clothing, and so on and so forth.
Well, the conditions in Bethlehem certainly were rather rudimentary at times, but you know, this can be exaggerated, and a sense of the institution as an unchanging institution is I think wrong. I mean, one can point to towards the end of the 17th century the introduction of, for example, a wardrobe at Bethlehem, which provided clothing for patients whose parishes didn't provide, the introduction of arms and a kind of temporary leaves of absence for patients as well, who were in a state of convalescence and recovery, introduced during the period of Edward Tyson's physicianship. So towards the end of the 17th century, early 18th century, you begin to see increasing focuses on the welfare of patients in terms of their material needs. But you also see physicians like Richard Hale developing a reputation for less of a reliance on external restraint, on mechanical restraint, and a reliance on the use of medicaments, opiates, for example. So we do see some elements of change in this period. And of course, Bethlehem moves to a glorious new palatial dwelling in the 17th century, which is a very important shift too.
We're not quite there yet. You're seeing the good side, and that's all. That's fine, and that's what you should see. But nevertheless, it was regarded as hell by most observers. I mean, we have a list of. It's in Wycliffe. It's in Tyndall. It's in Shakespeare several times. It's in Swift. It's in they all talk about it as a desperate place. So we'll leave it as desperate for the moment. But how did it get its broader reputation? This is a small place. even now, at the end there, through the 17th century, very small place. He becomes nationally notorious. All these writers and translators of the Bible are mentioning it, and they're mentioning it in the same terms as chaos and madness. How did it get that far?
I think that's a very, very interesting question, because until the latter part of the 17th century, really there are very, very few patients, maybe as many as 20 or 30. So it's not really a national project. But we know from the middle of the 16th century, there are ballads, the Tom o' Bedlam ballads that Shakespeare incorporates into King Lear. Certainly by the end of the 16th century, there are 20 or 30 plays that have Bedlam either as a situation or people from Bedlam as key players. And of course, by the 1630s, we've got very, very famous plays like Middleton's Changeling that actually have a play within a play that's set in Bedlam. And the key thing, I think, is that, you know, very often the Bedlam inmates are clowns. You know, we would find it pretty reprehensible to have that sort of character in a play on the television or at the theatre, using the clownish sort of vaudevillian behaviour of the mad as an entertainment, as humorous. But certainly by the time of Middleton, Bedlam is a space where you can think about what madness is. The liminality between being rational and being mad is very, very difficult for audiences. So in Middleton, the question that's posed is, what would you do for love? Would you pretend to be a madman to go into Bedlam with the possibility of having a relationship with somebody you love? And those sorts of questions, the instability of sanity in a world where, you know, the world is turned upside down, is very difficult.
That's a terrific survey, but can you pin it down? Why did Bedlam, that word and that particular small place, catch the imagination of so many people and become notorious and nationally referred to? Is there one reason or not?
Have
you given the answer?
Yeah, one reason that's been put forward is that certainly later in the century, people who go to the theatre have to go past Bedlam. So in some sense, there is a physical experience. But we also need to remember that insanity isn't just captured in these institutions. You know, we know from the case books of a minor sort of medical clergyman called Richard Napier, who's in operation until the 1630s. He sees hundreds, if not thousands, of people with mental problems, and he treats them in a whole range of different ways in their villages, in their localities.
Hilary Marland, as has been said, it became a tourist attraction. Can you develop that?
Yes, I can, and I think just to follow up on Justin's point, the other thing about Bethlehem to point out, until the 17th century, it is a one-off. It is the place in England where the mentally ill are treated, and as such, it becomes a major London tourist attraction.
Especially it's when it's new building Moorfields.
Exactly, new building in Moorfields is opened in 1676, and it's a palatial building on the outside. It's very impressive, and it becomes really part of a kind of Cook's tour of London. Visitors would go to Westminster Abbey, they would go to the Tower, they would see the fireworks, they would go dining, and they would go and visit the poor lunatics and observe the poor lunatics in Bethlehem. And Samuel Pepys talks of sending his cousin's children in 1669 as a treat. They were shown the lunatics of Bethlehem before being taken shopping and dining and to other sites of London.
Do they describe the lunatics? Are they interested in the differences that the lunatics have to the rest of people?
Yes, I think, there's a lot of interest in the sort of typology of madness, sort of presenting lunatics as different types, where it's the delusional monarchs, the lunatic that thinks he's a member of the royal family, or the overstudious lunatic, or someone who's there because they've lost a child, the infanticide lunatic. So there are these different perceptions of different types of people who were confined. And I think people had different motives for visiting. Bethlehem Hospital were rather fond of this idea of having visitors to the institution, because they charged a penny or tuppence to go into Bethlehem to observe the lunatics, and this was seen as an important source of revenue. And some people have argued as well that it wasn't solely bad. It gave the patients some contact with the outside world, and that some of the visitors almost acted as a form of overseers. And that contact with the outside world may have been quite important, and the patients were brought gifts sometimes or given money. And that perhaps observing these people in desperate circumstances was a kind of moral lesson as well. There are different ideas about what this visiting meant.
John and Andrews, we come to the Munros, who ran the place, the four generations, for 125 years. Can you tell us the dread story of the Munros?
Yes. Well, the Munro dynasty began with the appointment of James Munro, who was from a Scottish clan, who was the son of the principal of Edinburgh University. And he was the first physician at Bethlehem, outcompeted actually quite a strong number of other physicians for the post. There's rather little, surprisingly, known about James Munro, partly because he didn't actually publish. We know he practiced in Greenwich before he came to Bethlehem. We know, again, he had no specific experience with madness. But he gave his son John, who inherited the physicianship in the 1750s from James, having served an apprenticeship at Bethlehem. And it became almost natural then, after John had experienced a Radcliffe travelling fellowship, had gone to Leiden, had gone to Edinburgh, and again acquitted himself very well in committees, for John to inherit the physicianship.
And two more Munros to come.
Thomas to follow John, very much with a sense of almost a sinecure, an expectation. Although this wasn't unusual in medical dynasties, not just amongst physicians, but amongst surgeons, to attend through families. I mean, 18th century medical practice was often a family-run business.
When you said travelled, it sounds as if he went on the travel for his medical studies and enriched his knowledge of mental illness. No such thing.
Well, the Radcliffe Travelling Fellowships were about experiencing medicine at other universities, at practicing as a generalist.
But did they study what was still being called lunacy? Did they particularly study that?
No.
So they didn't study that. So they're
no,
in charge
they
of it.
They were generalists,
studied,
very much so. Okay. And in fact, it was partly through, and really it was the belief very much this time, was that madness was known through experience, empirically. John Munro was very protective of that notion, and to some extent that made him hesitant to go into print. In fact, this largely explains why very few Bethlehem physicians publish on insanity, and we don't see that we see the first publication on insanity by a Bethlehem physician almost forced into publication by his rival at St Luke's Hospital, William, eponymously and appropriately named Batty, at the rival St Luke's Hospital, Batty being a former governor of Bethlehem, St Luke's established in 1751. Munro forced really into print at the behest of the governors, because Batty had actually written some words that were implicit slights on the reputation of his father and on the reputation of Bethlehem. The accusation that to some extent a certain narrow corpus of medical men were keeping knowledge of insanity themselves by not publishing. Of course, St Luke's famously encouraged medical students to walk the wards and did so for much of the 18th century. Bethlehem never did and resisted that. And Munro argues very much, in fact, in his response to Batty's treatise on insanity, which is called Remarks on Dr. Batty's Treatise, his opening statement is that madness is a distemper of which very little of real use can be said. And in fact, he was very concerned that public debate about metaphysical notions of lunacy could actually deprive the public of confidence in the empirical skills of mad doctoring.
Is this all that the Justin? I'm looking to you now. It seemed to me from the notes that I read from you three and from a bit of reading around that the Munros let in no new air. ideas were being developed elsewhere about mental illness, but not with the Munros. They had a system and they stuck to it, and they did, again, as was successive people did with Bedlam, they creamed the money off the top. Now then, did anything else happen?
Well, I think, you know, underpinning the growth of that institution is the refoundation of the physical building, you know, designed and built by Robert Hooke in the 4 years.
He's everywhere.
He's absolutely everywhere. And Charles II comes as it's opened in the August to see this pretty, you know, powerful institution that, of course, have at the top the two statues, what Pope calls the Brainless Brothers, representations of mania and depression. And that sense of mental illness being not the result of something somatic, something physical, the Galenistic thing, is, I think, being replaced in the broader culture by the invention of the mind. You know, post Descartes, we understand that reason is what controls passion. Hobbes is very powerful at showing that religious actually has a pathological effect on the mind and drives people to prophecy and Lord knows what. The experience of the English Civil War with the world turned upside down, prophetesses who are locked up in Bedlam, Lady Eleanor Davis.
Just for being a prophetess.
Just for, well, and for occupying the Episcopal chair in a cathedral and claiming herself as bishop. But that sense in which pathology is caused by a derangement of reason, it becomes more dominant. It's an enlightenment mode, perhaps, and, you know, we could all debate about what is rational and what isn't, but I think that's something, as the anatomies of the brain get sorted out with people like Willis, that does change the sort of medical infrastructure.
So that's going on. That's an interesting development which we now in the 21st century can relate to. Ah, that's the beginning of something that led to the discussion that is now going on, different from the medieval diabolism and so on and so forth. On the other hand, Hilary, we know that we are told that Bedlam didn't change much, and so did how were people admitted there, and how were they, I've said this before, but how were they released, but more importantly, on what grounds were they admitted still in the late 17th, early 18th century?
Well,
in this particular place,
to be admitted you had to demonstrate, or your family or your friends, whoever was presenting you to the institution, to demonstrate you were poor and you were mad. And most of the patients who were admitted to Bethlehem would have been poor. They were labourers, minor tradesmen, people without much means. And there seems to have been almost a process of negotiation. Although it was a charity and it was reliable on benefactions and donations to run the institution, they did extract fees from the families or friends of the patients who were brought there. And it was almost a form of negotiation as they were brought to the hospital and admitted about how much they would pay. Patients were also sent by parishes through the poor law. Most patients were admitted from London or the London area, but some were brought from great distances as well to be treated in Bethlehem.
Is there much evidence of corruption on the side of the sender? As this, we know about corruption on the side of the receiver. Those who ran it seem to be, all of them, in it for money, profit. But what about people who send? Were people sending relatives away so they could get access to the will, that sort of thing?
Well, this is the 17th, perhaps even more so the 18th century, is the period of wrongful confinement, where there's a huge furore about the wrongful admittance of patients into asylums. And by this time, you also have a private asylum trade, which has grown up. And in fact, that is where the association with wrongful confinement is perhaps the strongest.
Lots of asylums all over the country.
Small ones, most often, but they're starting to proliferate, and they're money-making enterprises. Yeah. They run on a principle of payment, and again, these are mainly treating well-to-do patients. And in Bethlehem as well, you find also the better class of patient in smaller numbers. But probably by the 17th and 18th century, the private asylum is where these patients would end up.
Jonathan Andrews.
It has to be said, there was a process of a form of certification at Bethlehem. There's no requirement for a medical certificate, but from even the 1650s, governors specify that patients should be seen and vetted by a committee, and this really it's really post the Moorfields building and the move of Bethlehem in 1676. We see this sort of committee dirigism at Bethlehem, where we have Saturday viewing committees where patients are vetted, and if unfit for the charity, and that can mean if too weak to undergo the enervating physic, or if deemed to be idiot, if deemed to be incurable, let's say epileptic, or deemed to be, you know, costly for the institution, i.e. pregnant women, they'll be rejected. And we also see clear outs of patients from Bethlehem, patients found to be sane. Every now and then governors would visit, and again this was done both through lay governors' visits as well as visiting physicians, you'd see, and we see some evidence of an emphasis on the incurables insane being actually inappropriate for admission to Bethlehem. In fact, increasing numbers of the incurables are discharged and ejected from Bethlehem in the early 18th century, resulting in a huge appeal for the foundation of incurable wards. In fact, this actually generates a charitable response from the public and benefactions increasingly for the incurable insane, and then the building of two wards for incurables at Bethlehem in the 1720s and 1730s, first for male and then for female patients. These are famously, of course, depicted by Hogarth in the final scene of The Rake's Progress, the male incurables ward.
I want to ask you about, you say what you want, but I want one or two scandals, because they're big scandals.
I was just sort of thinking of, you know, the improper use of Bedlam. You know, there was a small political theme. I can't remember her name, Margaret Hamilton
Nicholson.
Who attempted to assassinate George III was encouraged to go into Bedlam. And of course, at a little while later, George III had his own mental problems. So there's the irony of the same doctor, you know, investigating whether she needs to be incarcerated or whether the king ought to be. Did the king?
Can we just get to one of the main points? There were massive scandals. One about an American who had been locked in a cage in which he could scarcely move. He couldn't really sit. He couldn't really stand for 10 years. He was then discovered by people who visited him, who knew a bit about things, saying, "Look, he's perfectly sane to me." And they tried to justify it that his wrists were too thin to put money. In fact, they were torturing him. Now then, that made a national scandal. What happened? Who was the man? What happened?
I don't know enough about him. I'm sure.
Who knows about it?
This is James Norris, an American Marine who was found in the condition of severe restraint with a harness that was effectively pinning his arms to his sides, a neck lock, and a chain that actually could be used by the keeper to draw him close in the adjacent cell. Now, what's often forgotten about Norris is that he was one of the most violent inmates Bethlehem had experienced. That not only were his wrists thin, but they were almost double jointed. He could get out of wrist locks. That this was a very unusual form of device that only Norris had experienced. But also that he'd attacked very brutally a member of staff and bitten the finger off a patient. But by the time he was found in Bethlehem, when Wakefield visits Bethlehem in 1814, he'd been in that situation, it seems, for roughly 9 years, and seemed to be quite coherent, able to give a good account of himself, was able to read newspapers, for example. So it was also about the state in which he was found. And this, of course, Norris became one of the core celebre cases that Wakefield brought this information, was scandalised by what he found. It wasn't the only thing he found. He found cells within Bethlehem where patients had seemed almost to be forgotten about, chained by their legs or by their arms to benches, in states of semi-nudity with blankets. This was a quite traditional way of dealing with incontinence in Bethlehem, because that obviously came with cleaning and expenses and time constraints, so it was easier to put blankets on patients. But there was a sense in which some of these patients had been really neglected.
Hilary, were alternative methods emerging, say, at the end of the 18th century, of dealing with people instead of naked on floors with blankets and, however violent, chaining them up like dogs in a kennel?
Well, to me, that's the greatest scandal of Bethlehem, that new alternative forms of treatment were emerging during the 18th centuries. And sometimes these were associated with the private asylums, as some of these were quite innovative and they were trying out new approaches. And the people who ran them claimed a good deal of expertise by this time in treating mentally ill patients. And one such was Francis Willis, who treated and perhaps cured George III from his madness. Perhaps the institution, though, which is always put as the strongest contrast to Bethlehem, was the York Retreat, which was established in 1796 by the Tuke family, a local Quaker family of tea merchants, not medical experts, but who had an interest in treating mental illness. And at the York Retreat and at other institutions, they devised a system which was known as moral management or moral therapy, which was very much based on establishing a regime of kindness and order, which would involve occupying the mind of patients, a good diet, encouraging rest and recreation. There wasn't much medical intervention. These were institutions that did not bleed or give lots of medicine to the patients. It was very much about a system of management. And the contrast between the York Retreat and Bethlehem, I think by the time of the 1815-16 inquiry was becoming very stark. And I think one of the strongest critiques of Bethlehem is that they, although the apothecary at Bethlehem from 1795, John Haslam, was interested in these new systems of management and even wrote about them, they did not put them into practice, it appears, at Bethlehem. So there were innovations, as Jonathan described, and a kind of more lenient regime and better conditions for the patients by the late 18th century. But somehow Bethlehem turned its back, really, I think, on these new approaches to treating mental illness.
So can we get a sense of time and place, Justin, particularly of time? We're at the end of the 18th century, and there's much investigation going into the nature of the mind, one way or another, in this, and all over Europe, really, in other parts too. Bedlam is lagging behind other institutions, especially the York Retreat, way ahead and being taken up all over Europe. What's happening in this country in the 19th century? Dickens is still going and visiting Bedlam as a spectacle.
And I think in one sense the persistence of Bedlam as an institution, and not as a physical space but as a sort of mental representation of the dangers of insanity, continues until today. We still use the language of Bedlam to describe things we don't like or things that threaten us. My sense is that certainly the legacy of more inquiries into the nature of the human mind, how does it work, how does it become unstable, the role of rationality, and I think it's Tyson says somewhere around 1700, madness is imposed by the mad on the less mad, and that tradition gets taken up later in the 20th century by historians of madness like Michel Foucault and more accessibly Roy Porter, who see this tradition as one of confinement and medicalization rather than real medical innovation. And I think I'm not familiar enough with the treatment of insanity or mental disorders today, but my sense is, if we look at things like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, brutal medical intervention, lobotomies, or massive pharmaceutical control is still a major issue. We just don't lock everybody up anymore. We don't confine them.
Jonathan, do you see any changes moving through the 19th century, marked changes in the institutions rather than the ideas?
Yeah, I mean, in particular, the model of the York Retreat, which it very much disseminates the doctrine of moral therapy to asylums generally, and there's much emulation of a more moral managerial practice in asylums. This means a shift towards an emphasis, for example, most importantly, on occupying insane, a kind of almost quasi-occupational therapy, with many a greater variety of occupations available in asylums. This includes the provision of workshops. Bethlehem itself gets workshops in the 1830s, for example. It also includes a programme of recreational activity. I mean, Dickens, of course, attends St. Luke's curious dance, as he calls it, around a curious tree, the weekly balls and dances that become a real feature of the Victorian asylum, that are both a publicity op for the asylum to actually open itself out, to bring in musicians, to bring in performers, and to involve patients and staff in interactions. But they're also a time to demonstrate the kind of good behaviour of patients and the sense of the morally reformed asylum. We're also seeing a significant shift of emphasis in terms of of medical treatments at this time, more criticisms of standard evacuation, reliance on bleeding, purges and vomiting. We're seeing a shift towards, for example, the use of chloral hydrate, chemical preparations, sulfonyl, opiate concoctions. So and also the use not of restraint, but the use of self-restraint and seclusion. An emphasis on, in fact, increasingly on non-restraint from the 1830s and 40s, with the work of Connolly and others at Hanwell, for example.
Hilary Marlin, were these new, when these new drugs were brought in, do we see effects from them? Do we see, are the reports that we read, oh, these are better than flogging and purging and so on?
I think, I think there's a positive response to these new innovations and the use of sedatives, as Jonathan pointed out, rather than the manacles and chains of old. And I think also this idea of management, in a way, Bethlehem does start to fall into line with other public institutions, and you have a lot of big public institutions by the 19th century which are managed by the lunacy commissioners, who would visit asylums regularly to assess treatments, to see the patients, see the state the patients were kept in. And after the 1850s, Bethlehem is also under the auspices of the Lunacy Commission. And they start to get innovative medical superintendents brought in. Someone called Charles Hood becomes medical superintendent in 1852. And the big difference with Dr. Charles Hood is he lives in Bethlehem. He's a resident superintendent, so he has much more day-to-day contact with the patients, observing their day-to-day improvement and recovery in some cases.
So let's assume that Bethlehem itself, let's stick to Bethlehem for the last few seconds, Bethlehem itself improved. Is there an improvement also in the general national consciousness about mental health, about lunacy? As it was still called, that still called in my childhood.
Yes, I mean, I think if we take the long view, from the foundation as a priory, the development of the institution as a hospital for the poor and mad, and then the creation of something called an asylum, the project has to have been beneficial. But one of the things we, even as inquisitive historians, often miss is the voice of the mad, the voice of the powerless mad person. And we have fragments. There's a clergyman at the end of the 17th century called George Tross, who published an autobiography. He drank himself into insanity. He had a period in the hospital, and then came out again and wrote about it. And for him, the problem was always in his mind and with God. And my intuition is that as the pressure of religious orthodoxy gets weaker, perhaps we get less need for asylums.
Well, thank you very much to Justin Champion, Hilary Marlin and Jonathan Andrews. Next week we'll be talking about Elizabeth Barrett Browning's epic poem Aurora Leigh. Thanks for listening.
And the In Our Time podcast gets some extra time now with a few minutes of bonus material from Melvin and his guests.
I mean, I think one of the things that's fascinating me more and more, partially because there's this easily accessible catalogue online of prints and drawings that the British Museum has, and you can search by word or concept, is the representation, visual representation of madness and insanity gets, I don't know, into the 19th century, but certainly in the 17th and 18th century, gets increasingly politicised. You are driven mad by priestcraft or drink or Tories. And that sort of visualization, I think, is very, very interesting to think about how it goes back to your question, Melvin, about how do people know about Bedlam? If you're cranking out ballads and broadsheets with little representations, these are cheap. There was a broadsheet, wasn't there, in the 1740s,
yeah,
supposedly written by an inmate, yeah, who says,
with a poem and an image attached.
Yes, and the word priestcraft is used, yes, in one of the first sort of times to say this is what's making you mad. But the image is incredible.
Well, that's true, but I think even more so, it's the literature actually produced by both writers from a literary vein and the visitors of Bethlehem, who recycle their visits and often recycle visits on the basis of other accounts that they've read. So there's an awful lot of intertextuality that is actually making Bedlam it building this sense of Bedlam as a touristic resort. And those, and I think one of the things we missed in our discussion was that is what changes, why it is that Bethlehem actually closes its doors to indiscriminate visiting in 1769 to 70.
Oh, yes, we should have said that.
And this kind of major shift, attitudinal shift, as the fun almost goes out of the freak show of Bethlehem, and you have an increasing volley of critical write-ups of visits to Bethlehem, really excoriating the behaviour of the masses in particular in the periodical magazine literature of the 18th century, in particular from the 1740s, 50s and 60s, when we know that visiting is actually at its height, when Bethlehem is more popular than ever as a resort. St Luke's, of course, closes its doors to indiscriminate visitors, doesn't allow visitors except the friends and families, and is actually rather chary of allowing friends and families in to visit patients. All of the second generation of lunatic hospitals founded after 750s also follow governor-ticketed visiting practices or set visiting hours. And Bethlehem is rather belated once again in actually meeting the demand, meeting the critique with action. And quite interestingly, John Monroe, even when he remarks on Battier's treatise, suggests that visiting is actually can be actually quite problematic, can be good and bad, and he largely excludes what he confines what he's saying about visiting to his private practice, almost ignoring what's going on at Bethlehem. But what we are seeing is a significant shift in public attitudes, a sense in which the visiting of Bedlam is always consigned to the prostitute whipping side that goes on at Bridewell of public entertainment, and a sense in which it becomes seeking out inmates who are entertaining, who are fun. It becomes a matter of seeking out the most moving stories to tell, a sense of engaging with sensibilities, a sense also of recognising the sensibilities and feelings of the patients being visited. So we see much more dialogic visitors' reports and interactions, I think.
And what we also see is the patient's view, the patient's account, which we didn't really talk about, that they themselves produce literature, pamphlets or books, recording their experience, either their experience of being mentally ill, and many acknowledged that they were not wrongfully confined, but many were making complaints against institutions and relatives and friends for wrongfully confining them. But we also get a really good insight into conditions, and Urbain Metcalfe wrote a very interesting pamphlet in 1818 describing his experiences of being in Bethlehem, and he acknowledged he had been mentally ill. He thought he was an heir to the Danish royal family. He was delusional. He needed to be there or somewhere, but he did report on the terrible conditions in Bethlehem, the poor diet, the cold, the lack of hygiene, and also commented, of course, on the actual medical treatment that was being meted out in this period. So the patients too give us this wonderful, rich insights into what these institutions, not just Bethlehem, were really like during this period.
Well, we're going to be released now, everyone, because here's Simon Tillotson, the producer, to make you an offer you can't refuse.
It's tea or coffee, what would you like?
Coffee, please. Coffee.
There are many more history and discussion programmes from Radio 4 to download for free. Find these on the website at bbc.co.uk/radio4.